Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spangin. On today's show... I've been looking desperately for silver linings, listener, so before we begin this episode, here's a few that have given me comfort over the past few days. It's been a good week for investigative journalism, with the New York Times publishing Donald Trump's tax returns, Britain's Channel 4 uncovering Trump's 2016 efforts to keep black voters away from the polling stations, and huge revelations from leaked financial documents in the FinCEN files. Meanwhile, six Israeli wineries won gold medals at the 2020 Decanter World Wine Awards, and three Israeli telecommunications companies have been granted 5G operating licenses. Joining me today to discuss slightly less uplifting issues, we've got Chaim Levinson and Anshul Pfeffer. Are we doing well, gents?
Shana tova.
Shana tova, gmar chatima tova. How are you, Chaim?
Amazing.
Wow. Was not expecting that. So, guys, we're a week and a half into Israel's second lockdown, which Health Minister Yuli Edelstein said today will not end on October the 11th, as promised.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, it could even be extended by a month or more, he said. So what happened over Yom Kippur? Was there any sign that the disobedient, insubordinate Israeli public is finally heeding the restrictions?
Look, I don't think. When we entered this lockdown 2 weeks ago, it was clear that it will not end in a week or 2 or 3 weeks. And by the way, I'm still waiting to the government decision. What is the exact criteria to end the lockdown? Mm. They're still discussing what exactly they're trying to achieve. We'll see now, I mean now on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, the numbers that because of the lockdown of the New Year's, when people went 1 day or 2 days before to meet their families instead in the New Year's Day. So we will see it now. When we'll see another 10 days, what happened in the Yom Kippur? What happens? But this is, I think, mainly in the ultra-Orthodox society. So maybe we will see a big difference between the general population and the ultra-Orthodox society that will give us indication where exactly we are standing with the pandemic. But for sure, I told my wife, don't think about sending the schools will come back before the beginning of December. It will be a miracle if such a thing will happen.
Mm. So what did actually happen over Yom Kippur then?
Yom Kippur was a very normal day for part of the Israeli public.
A very normal Yom Kippur.
A very normal Yom Kippur, and for others it was a very special or very different Yom Kippur, and it all depends on where you stand within Israeli society. But just to carry on from what Chaim was saying before, this is already 8 months into the crisis where the government's policy is shoot first and ask questions later. Like, first of all, they say, we're going to do this. We're going to do a lockdown. We're going to do this. We're going to close this. We're going to close that. And then once they've made a decision, once they've announced it, then over the next 24, 40 hours, suddenly they work out, actually, are we going to do this? Half the time, then actually, no, we're not going to do this. Or what are the details? And this is what we're seeing now with the lockdown. The lockdown was announced 2.5 weeks ago. It would be in a week and it would include this and that. Then over the week, Netanyahu, of course, was in Washington, but the whole framework and the details were hashed out. And until the very last moment, we didn't know when schools would be closing. We didn't know how long the lockdown was supposed to be. We didn't know if it would be 500 or 1,000 meters. None of these details were published, and the public didn't find out, in some cases, only after they went into effect. And the same thing is happening now with the intensification of the lockdown and with, as you mentioned, Yuli Edelstein, the health minister, rather hapless health minister. We haven't yet really seen any kind of real policy coming from him. He's, what, 3-4 months now in the job, Chaim?
4 months.
4 months,
even
yeah.
More.
There's no policy coming from him. There's nothing, you know, his presence isn't felt. It's still all the decisions, such as they are, being made from the Prime Minister's office. He didn't really tell us anything we didn't know. As Chaim told his wife, you know, none of us know when this lockdown is going to end, not Yuli Edelstein. The government will be playing it by ear as it goes. And when they'll announce that the lockdown is ending, then the day after they'll say, actually, no, wait a bit, it's not ending yet. There's no criteria for when the lockdown should be eased. There's no timetable for when the new arrangements for our lives, whether it's testing or contact tracing will be in place. It's all just, you know, fly by night.
Israel isn't unique in that respect, right? This is the same situation everywhere in the world. In the UK, they're talking about the R number and getting the R number down, and until that number doesn't go down below a certain level, then the restrictions will continue. That this isn't unique to Israel.
No, a lot of countries are failing as well, and every failing country has its own unique characteristics, and this is the ultimate test, the stress test of governments and of leaders. And we've seen leaders who have done well, and we've seen leaders who are failing and failing badly. And sadly, Israel is one of the worst in that aspect.
Mm. So what did we see over the last 24, 36 hours? Did we see any change?
Well, I think Yom Kippur is very much where you were. Chaim was in Tel Aviv, and maybe he'll say a bit of what he saw. In Jerusalem, it was very much a question of, were you in ultra-Orthodox Jerusalem, in the Haredi neighborhoods of the north and south, or of central south Jerusalem, of where neighborhoods are more mixed and you have a much wider variety of people according to their religious persuasions. And within the Haredi neighborhoods, the synagogues were packed, the yeshivot were packed. Some of them had sort of a semblance of, for appearances of a bit of, you know, some plastic sheeting and bubbles, but they weren't really effective, and some of them quite clearly were ignoring any kind of coronavirus precautions. In the other neighborhoods, I think it was that there was actually a very positive, and for people, you know, a lot of people found it a very optimistic phenomenon of the outdoor prayers, in which, you know, most of the synagogues were closed in the other neighborhoods, and people gathered in backyards and gardens and parks, and sometimes at the side of the road, and, you know, sort of keeping distancing, but it was very much an open kind of prayer. There were no barriers. There was no barrier between men and women. And it was just a very different kind of Yom Kippur. And moving, you know, I walked in both types of neighborhoods over Yom Kippur, moving from, it was almost like being in a different kind of Jewish world, a totally different kind. It was the same prayer, but everything else was different.
Mm. What was it like in Tel Aviv, Chaim?
Look, I live in a very traditional neighborhood. I can tell most of the people were praying outside. Even so, too many people, and very small gardens. And you know the mask, so you have the mask, then you take off the mask, then it's too hot, you bring it off and back and back and forth. And you know how it is. It's not ideal situation, but we will see. I think it will be a crucial moment to understand where exactly we're standing in the pandemic. I mean, next week, to see what happened in Yom Kippur, how it will affect the numbers. If we will see it's only in the ultra-Orthodox society, the growth, and we see a decrease in different cities, or it will be all around the country. But we will need to wait.
Mm. Do we think that there's a chance that we've learned the lessons from May, when the lockdown was lifted too precipitously, too quickly?
I don't think the lockdown was lifted too quickly. The main problem was the schools. You see in the data, it's all about the schools. You see the raise in September started when the yeshivot came back on the 24th of August. You see immediately the effect of young male between the age of 10 and 19 and 20 and 29, a huge growth in the numbers, and you see immediately the effect of opening the schools all around the country on the 1st of September. In June, July, after they were lifting very quickly, you saw we are stable around 2,000 a day. So 2,000 a day, maybe it's too much, but it's still something we can handle. What you see the numbers very clearly. The schools destroy us. And by the way, everyone knows that the government was warned. They decided, Netanyahu bragged, that we will show the pandemic, that we will cope with it. And we see now. We see the situation now. By the way, Netanyahu, I don't know if you saw his weird live view yesterday night. He said that maybe the schools was a mistake. Maybe.
Mm. Well, it's nice that he's taking some of the responsibility. Until now, he's blamed Israelis, right?
Yeah, who's to blame, by the way, the schools? Me? And, you know, he says also the events, gardens, was also the weddings, etc., has also caused a huge problem. By the way, it's true. But maybe speak with some of your ministers of the cabinet that were part of this opening the event gardens, etc.
I mean, he also he gave a speech last Thursday, I think it was. It feels like a million years ago, and the days are all blurring into one. He said he's working on a vaccine.
He said I am working on a vaccine. Which,
absolutely.
You know, he has a degree in architecture and business administration. Yeah. I didn't know he has one in any kind of medical science.
Yesterday, he started to speak about his learning from George Washington. how to handle a pandemic. No, seriously. He read a book about it.
Okay. Well, maybe we should all be reading that book.
It's like Jared Kushner's 25 books that he read before he solved the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Bibi also blamed populist politicians, which I found deliciously ironic. He mentioned Yair Lapid by name, I think. He accused him of pushing for the economy to reopen too swiftly and endangering the lives of Israeli citizens by politicizing Israel's recovery. Now the focus is political again, right? The attention goes back to the Knesset?
You have the demonstration issues that's still discussed in the Knesset, regarding the regulations and demonstration, not in the emergency area, but in the second stage.
Right, Netanyahu wanted to
close it completely until the end of the pandemic, and the blue and white doesn't agree. They want some kind of arrangement that you will have between the emergency tight period and the going back to business period. So it's still discussed. I assume they will find a solution today, but I don't think the parliament will. And the numbers we have today of 8,000 and the number tomorrow that I'm sure it will be above 10,000 today because of the Yom Kippur. So I assume people didn't go to be tested. So you will not see it today, but tomorrow for sure it will be above 10,000. I don't think any member of the parliament will interfere with the decisions of a government. It's hard to believe.
So you think that the demonstrations will be limited to 1 kilometer from people's homes?
Yeah. During the emergency time, like the upcoming 2, 3, 4 weeks, the tight lockdown.
Mm.
What will happen in the in-between tight lockdown and opening back, it's still to be discussed.
Mm. And presumably that won't actually stop the demonstrators from going out and setting up presence on the flyovers intersections.
I was driving down just an hour ago from Jerusalem, and almost all the way from Jerusalem down to Shaar HaGai, about 15 or 20 kilometers, it was blocked with a convoy going up to Jerusalem. So one of the things that they're planning to do is say, okay, we can't stand in groups together, but we can drive. So that's going to be another challenge to the lockdown changes that we'll have. Instead of personal people standing in the streets, protests, we'll have vehicular protests of cars, and they're already driving around Jerusalem in circles as we speak. So that there's going to be that kind of... these are all kinds of different attempts to challenge the rules. But I think that in some ways they're playing into Netanyahu's hands, because making the protest, which is a minor issue, yes, there probably have been some infections at the open-air protests, but there's no question. No medical expert, even those who were saying that it's probably better if it didn't exist, no one's saying this is a main source of infection.
Well, apart from Netanyahu, he's saying that, no?
He had actually said that in so many words, but he wants the focus, the news agenda, to be on them. Because if the news agenda is not going to be on them, it's going to be on one of two things. It's going to be on his mismanagement going back now 8 months of this pandemic, and it's going to be of the way his closest political allies, the ultra-Orthodox community, are blatantly breaking the coronavirus guidelines. So to move the focus of the agenda and to make... And the public... are not happy. The majority of the public are not happy with the fact that the protests are going on. So it's a very useful red herring for him to use to divert the attention. And you know, Chaim mentioned before that, and I think he's quite rightly, that the lockdown wasn't ended precipitously. It was ended without the necessary mechanisms in place. There was no contact tracing apparatus. Testing was still very haphazard, slow, and in relatively low numbers. Now, the government had the time before mid-May, when the previous lockdown was ended, to at least hire the people you needed for the contact tracing and at least have ramp up the testing. Now, the testing has only been ramped up now, and as we have in today's paper report by Yaniv Kobovich and Bar Peleg, the IDF are still having trouble drafting the reservists and the soldiers that they need for the contact tracing now that's with the army. And obviously the army is going to be in charge of it. But the army is even taking time. Now, a lot of this could have been done by May, but none of this would have even started by May. So beyond the fact, as Chaim said, that the reopening of schools and yeshivot was done not carefully, we have this whole necessary... Everybody, it's not a... it's not a mystery. Everybody in the world nowadays knows that you need contact tracing and you need high testing capabilities to not just flatten the curve, but to keep the curve flat, because Israel did flatten the curve. We were down at one point in May to five new infections in one day. Now we're latest, we're already around 8,000. So that's not, you know, it's a clear decision or lack of decision on the government going back to May. And this is what Netanyahu needs to continue deflecting attention from, because these are big mistakes. Some of them he's starting slightly to admit, but he doesn't want the public to dwell on them. And the other thing about resuming schools, there's not just resuming schools and studying yeshivot, it's now ending it, because we're now, last night at Yom Kippur ended, that's the end of the first term, of the short Elul term of the yeshivot, 40 days from the beginning of the month of Elul to Yom Kippur. And then in one drove, 50 or 60 or 70,000 yeshiva students go home. So it's not just the fact that people were praying together Yom Kippur. It's now we have this mini migration within Israel of all these young men and teenage boys who are sitting together in close proximity, and many of them, as we know, we probably don't know all of them, because a lot of them won't get tested, but many of them have become infected, and now they're going back to their homes in small cramped apartments in Haredi neighborhoods, and that's going to be a massive spike over the next week or two. And all this could have been foreseen. It's not like people didn't know that the yeshiva term ends on the night after Yom Kippur. This was something that could have been planned, and try and work out some kind of way to test them all, and make sure that they don't go back and infect their families. Instead, what we had is on Sunday, a few hours before Yom Kippur began, suddenly Netanyahu remembers to have a meeting with the heads of the Corona Task Force, and what are we going to do with all these young men going back home?
And in the end, there was no solution, and we saw photographs of dozens, if not hundreds.
They're all back home. Nobody waited around for orders from the government of how to of in what order they should travel back to their homes.
Is Netanyahu in any fit state to handle this crisis? In one of Amos Harel's daily analyses over the past few days, he reported that Bibi appears to be losing it, shouting at cabinet ministers, banging his fist on the table, and basically steamrolling his way through these meetings.
Look, I think the cabinet meetings are completely inefficient, but it's not because of the ministers, it's because of Netanyahu. It's all political, it's nothing professional. When 80% of the time you're discussing the demonstration like it's the most important thing on earth, and you don't discuss many other issues, like Angel mentioned, the ultra-Orthodox issue. And also professional issues. For example, many countries shortened the time of the quarantine. It's a huge amount of data that we don't need the 14 days. We need maybe only 12 days and 10 days. It can assist the public also to keep the quarantine orders, because everyone understands the 14 days is useless. And none of these issues are discussed. It's just a political show, and from Netanyahu's side or from the other people's side, and I understand why he doesn't have the patience for that. But it's a matter of leadership. When Netanyahu will acknowledge, from my opinion, his mistakes, and stop bragging how successful he is, etc.,
and tell the how he knows the better than the experts.
And in this weird live view again yesterday, he started to speak that the other countries are going to follow us on the second lockdown. So I can imagine another month he will say, "Look, we are the best in the world. We're the first one to go to the second lockdown." But if it will be all political and everything, the demonstrations. This is how it looks like.
Who's advising him?
No one.
He's himself.
The thing is that Netanyahu believes that Israel is at a bigger risk of losing him than at coronavirus. Netanyahu has convinced himself over years now that the worst thing that can happen to the state of Israel is that it has a weak, indecisive prime minister instead of him. And he believes that he's sacrificing himself for Israel, and therefore he can't see.
It sounds like he's sacrificing Israelis for himself in this particular case.
But he doesn't see it that way. He sees himself as, you know, you see at his birthday parties his children and his wife saying, "Thank you so much that you've sacrificed. I mean, if you were in the private sector, you would be making billions." They're convinced of that he would have been a billionaire. And instead, you are here serving us, because without you, this country is lost. And Netanyahu sincerely believes that. And we're seeing this kind of reasoning going on in other parts of the country. It's the kind of reasoning we're seeing in the Haredi community. They believe that if they give up on their mass gatherings in Yeshivot and in Betei Midrash and synagogues, then their community is at risk. And that risk is a greater risk, as far as they're concerned, than the risk of infection and even death from COVID-19. And everywhere in the world, individuals and communities and countries are doing a trade-off now. You know, we have to make this trade-off between the precautions we take for COVID and the semblance of normal life we sacrifice. So we decide that going to a restaurant or a pub or to just do some shopping is a risk, but it's a risk we're going to take because we need it for our normal lives or going to work or whatever we do now has a certain risk, and we have to make the trade-off. We have to work out which is the bigger risk. Yes, we can stay at home, isolate ourselves, never go out for the next, who knows, until there's a vaccine, but we may go mad and we may not be able to keep a semi-functioning society. And everyone is making those trade-offs. And Netanyahu's trade-off is that he has to stay prime minister, and that's worth every sacrifice. For the Haredim, the trade-off is that they have to carry on praying in large groups and studying Torah in yeshiva. That's a sacrifice they're going to make. Chaim, I think, thinks that going to a restaurant is a big
sacrifice.
Enough. Yeah,
it's very hard. I mean.
No, it is. We all have our trade-off.
So there is an equivalency between the right to demonstrate and the right to gather for prayer.
That's a trade-off as well.
I saw someone wrote last week that Israel had a chance last week to decide whether it was more democratic or more Jewish and decided that it was neither. Is that fair?
I think it all depends on your definition of democracy and your definition of Judaism.
Of course. Was Netanyahu put out by the Washington Post report about his alleged use of the White House to literally launder his dirty washing?
I don't think it had any effect here in Israel. No one. It's a well-known story. It's everyone knows on the weird habits that the family has. I was amused a little bit to read the response from people in the United States that they didn't know about it, and it's the first time they heard. But it's the laundry issue there. It's a well-known
Raviv Drucker,
problem.
Haaretz columnist reported it already 9 years ago that before every trip, Sarah prepares bags of dirty laundry.
And by the way, I'm not sure it's dirty. I think they just wanted to rewash.
She likes the package. She likes everything.
Yeah, to pack
to
everything separately.
Especially which you don't get from any, even the best Israeli laundries don't do that kind of service.
Don't pack it up,
So Teflon BB, this nothing much as Donald Trump's tax returns.
Yeah, I think it's a funny story. I don't think it's such an important story. Yes. It's not, you know, abusing low-class workers and his house. Mm. It's just, you know, it's just a weird habit, I must say. Just a weird one.
And it's similarly, the New York Times reports about Donald Trump, perhaps, off a duck's back.
I will not. First of all, we don't know how the New York Times will be affected. But I think the New York Times report about Trump is sitting on a completely different issue that... who's the system working for that is speaking to the people, the voters in the United States? Maybe to a small percentage, but still an important percentage. Here in Israel, you know, this is, it's like stories about the ancient kings and young ladies. You know, it's just for the fun.
I think where there is a similarity between this type of report of Netanyahu family abusing its position and Trump cheating on his taxes, assuming that
allegedly,
yes, and so on, is that I don't think this is going to change very much what anybody thinks, whether in Israel about Netanyahu or in the States about Trump. Mm. It's baked in. I don't think any of Trump's supporters really think that the man paid hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes, and they even probably admire him for being there. And in the same way here in Israel, you know, a lot of Likudnikim believe all these stories about Netanyahu and still say, we don't mind. We still think he's the best prime minister. We want him to remain prime minister. And we're fine with him. Some say we're fine with him having his laundry and whatever is done. And some say we don't really like it, but he's still the best prime minister. I don't think this is going to change where either Israelis or Americans stand on their leaders right now, this kind of report.
Mm. Are we looking forward to tonight's debate? Are you going to stay up and watch it?
First of all, it's not tonight. It's a 4 o'clock in the morning debate. I'm not going to stay up and watch it. I will, you know, I can. It's a thing called YouTube today. You can enter it, and you can re-watch whatever you want. You don't need to wait to get up in weird hours to watch the debate. Unfortunately, I will watch it, but.
And Chaim's the only American citizen in this room.
So
this is true.
I decided who I'm going to vote for, so I don't need a debate.
A non-floating voter. Have you got your postal ballot in already?
No, that's I didn't get my ballot in, so maybe I will not vote. But it's not so important. Anyway.
Which state are you voting in? Okay.
So it's not so important. Yeah.
Guys, before we wrap things up, and since yesterday was Yom Kippur, do either of you have anything you'd like to atone for?
I'd like to atone for Chaim.
Well, I would like to apologize to you, Chaim.
You didn't bring coffee to this English podcast. You know, the Hebrew podcast, they call you in advance to ask you what you want to drink.
Well, so I can call for you. That. I apologize for that.
And sometimes sandwiches as well.
I apologize. I can call you and ask what you want to drink, but I can't guarantee that they'll be here when you get here. And I would like to apologize for a crack I made a few months ago about your accent. When you talk English, I apologize deeply for that.
That's the least of Chaim's faults.
And Anshul, many years ago, when I was a novice translator on the Haaretz English News Desk, and we still translated your articles from Hebrew, I made an embarrassing error in one of your pieces, which I've never confessed to and have felt bad about for years. So apologies to both of you. Confession does feel good for the soul.
Yeah, but you have to tell me what the mistake was.
Once we're not recording.
Okay.
Thank you.
So I'll wait till then to forgive you.
Listener, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks, Chatima Tova, and to Chaim Levinson, to Anshul Pfeffer, to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich. We'll be back again next week with another episode of Haaretz Weekly. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.